more you expect of yourself, the more pressure you put on yourself at every tournament, the harder it is to keep going.
The highest level is insane. Like, it's a completely different game.
Podcast. This is episode 9, Gaming the Game. My name's Mike, and this is a little bit of a different podcast than we'd normally do. This is a conversation that came off the back of a question we got on our Facebook page. You can check us out if you jump on Facebook and search for Objective Secured. And you're more than welcome to ask questions of us, send us private messages or anything like that via that format. But in the meantime, we asked the question of what would you like to see us start covering for local and international news for not just 40k but gaming in general, and particularly because we've got 8th edition 40k about to come out. And so one of our locals here, Ryan, asked the question about the Perth meta game. And so as it transpires, my wife and I, Emma, who's been on the show before, she asked me that question when she first saw it. We were in the car, and then we basically decided to record it on the spot. So the audio you're about to hear sadly has a lot of road noise, but it's a pretty valid conversation, and one that, having listened back to it now and tried to clean up the audio as best I can, it touches on a few really interesting topics and ideas. So as much as I'd like the audio to be nicer and cleaner, I still think it's going to be a really interesting one for people to listen to. So I really hope you enjoy it. This is us talking about the metagame and Perth and what that means, and we kind of get a little bit sidetracked at the end there, but if you've listened to any of our previous episodes, you'll probably realise that that's a pretty common thing, and editing helps fix a lot of that. So I'm going to just let the episode jump straight into our conversation in the car. Hopefully the audio is not terrible, and you know, you can take something away from it. So without further ado, here's our half-hour conversation on the meta of Perth.
Facebook page asking about Perth meta.
So meta, it's not a term I like for 40k, it's a bit of a weird one. Meta in this particular instance references the game within the game, so how you build your army to suit your local playing conditions, so what opponents you're likely to face, what armies they like to field. It basically plays into the idea of being able to make yourself stronger in that environment by knowing what's likely to turn up. So whether your meta is flyer heavy because everyone likes running lots of planes, or whether they like running lots of super heavies, or whether they run hordes or Death Stars, it's a way of judging the way your community plays the game and what they prefer to use.
So does this undermine people's actual ability to play the game if people think that they're building lists only to win within their community?
I don't think so. I think the players who understand the game and know what they're doing are always going to be able to function within whatever meta, because at the end of the day, those players make units work because they know what they're doing. So when you step outside your own sandbox and start playing in an environment you're not familiar with new players and new armies, you can go in unprepared, and it can leave you in a very bad position where you are unprepared, and you find yourself in a, you know, bringing exactly what other players were expecting you to bring, or you can come in and surprise everyone because they're not used to dealing with a different form. So I think the best opportunity is actually to play what you want to play, not necessarily play to a meta.
Okay, so I know that you, when you go going over to LBO, you were trying to take an army that was, you went out to try and win.
Yeah. I did a lot of research on what I was expecting, but in the end took choices that would normally be considered poor or not optimized, which kind of plays against that idea of the meta where you bring just the best things you possibly can for the environment you're playing in, and that was partly driven by financial concerns, it was partly driven by my need to stop painting, where I painted what I needed to paint and wanted to paint something different. And as it turns out, those choices, some of them worked really well, some of them not so well. On paper, at least, they were the wrong choices. But in the end, the flexibility they gave me at the event, people not used to seeing them, actually ended up in my favour. So
on paper, you should have taken Jet Bike, you should have taken Firestorm.
Yeah, I had a pair of Wasp Walkers from the Corsair range, and I had a Nightwing Interceptor, neither of which are, under 7th edition at least, are good picks over simply taking more jet bikes with heavy weapons. They're not as cost effective for the firepower you get, they're probably less durable than the jet bikes as well, they're less flexible, they're not scoring. There's a whole raft of reasons why you would take jet bikes any day of the week over those units. And while the Nightwing didn't really perform over the weekend when I ran it, the Wasp Walkers, up between the practice games, the games they'll be on, the games I've played with that army since, are something that I'll always take now because they work really well for me, and they surprise a lot of people because most people just shrug and go, oh, I don't have to worry about them, they're not jet bikes.
So, you did want to paint people jet bikes, but you didn't take any more jet bikes, but you're not really selling the units that you did take. You're saying that they didn't work, so why would you pick them?
Partly those units, originally they were picked for aesthetic reasons. I thought I could make them work. And like I say, the Wasp Walkers, once I put them on the table and started playing games with them, I decided, yeah, they really suit the way I like to play. They give me flexibility in deployment. They give me other options that the jet bikes could perform, but didn't perform in the same way, which gave me a lot of opportunity on the tables to change my opponent's target selection and thought process as to how I was creating threats for them. A big thing for jet bikes is that mobility, and the Wasps don't have that, but they're almost as mobile. They pack a decent amount of firepower, they can assault and they can win, which is a really big thing for my list because I didn't really have an assault unit, and they also gave me the ability to outflank, to deep strike. They had a whole range of opportunities that the jet bikes just didn't fulfill, and in the end turned out to be a really solid choice. For the price of those two Wasp Walkers, I could have probably gotten 5 jet bikes, so it's one extra gun, there's more wounds, better saving throws, and on paper it looks like it's a clear decision for the jet bikes. In reality, what I found was it was anything but, because I found it more tactically advantageous to have other options.
So I guess from the Perth gaming community, what I hear most often is people undermining wins. Because he was playing Eldar, but he was playing Tau. So it's almost as though those wings have less credibility because they're playing with a strong army. I did have a question, but I thought you were going to cut me off. So what I'm asking is, do you think that that is, well, I mean, I personally don't think that's a warranted criticism, because I think if you play with a really strong army but if you suck as a player, you're not going to win. So you have to know how to use your army and how to play your army regardless of what it is and regardless of strength. But my question is, do you think that that's something that's universal, in that Tau and Eldar are stronger armies, or do you think that that's something that is unique to the way that Perth players play?
No, look, I mean, the data from around the world says that there are very different power levels within codexes. In the 7th edition, of course, we don't know for 8th, but for 7th edition, there was very definitely a top 2 or 3 or maybe 4 army lists that were universally used by the top players because they did have units that overperformed for under points values. And then you had a big chunk in the middle tier and then your handful at the bottom tier because they didn't operate within the metagame that the top ones created. So what I mean by that is a Dark Eldar army on paper looks pretty solid. However, a lot of its units are overpriced in 7th edition. A lot of them don't. You're kind of limited to what you can actually put in the army for points efficiency and to get the maximum number of units and shots. And then the armies they were very good at, you didn't see lots of because they didn't do well against the best armies. The trick with that is that when you start metagaming and using army lists found on the internet, you have to be prepared for the fact that there are counters because they're a public list and people come up with ways of dealing with it. One of the big spoiler armies, and it's Dark Eldar are what I consider a spoiler army. The biggest spoiler army in 7th edition was the Gene Stealer cult, because they allowed a player, I've never heard of a Gene Stealer player winning a tournament, but I always heard of them taking out top players before they hit the top tables, because they did really well against some of the meta heavy armies that would normally just go unchallenged through the rounds, and then all of a sudden they might encounter this Gene Stealer cult army, see themselves lose a game, and that's the end of the event for them, because they've copped a very hard counter. So the meta can often put you in a position where, you know, you think you've covered your bases, and then someone takes something that's completely out of the box, and they win games with it, and no one's prepared for it. And the best players are the ones who don't sit within the meta. They look outside the box, and they drive it by making changes and finding ways of making things work that other people think shouldn't. And then they win games with it as people start adapting and changing to meet that current threat. But those players have already moved on because they've already thought of the next thing and they've moved to the next army.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I saw it very clearly at LVO where you walked around the room and one in four players had a Riptide Wing and a bunch of people were running the Warp Spiders and Scatterbikes and Wraith Knights from the previous year's LVO. There were a lot of very similar armies from the high-end tables of LVO for 2016. And those 2017 players who ran those lists from a year earlier didn't make the top tables because they were playing a year behind what everyone else was playing.
So I guess you want to be the person leading, not the person who's following and copying somebody else's winning list.
Well, I took a list to Crags a couple of weeks ago, four-game tournament, and it was a list I'd always wanted to try for 7th edition and never got around to, and I thought, this is a good reason to do it. The last tournament,
I'm going to do it before I run outside.
But before they change the rules on me, and I can't do it because I don't know what it's going to mean. So I put the army together, put it on the table. The first game I lost.
Any hindsight, you probably should practice in the
hand. Yeah, look, it would have helped. It didn't help that I unpacked the army on Thursday night and played with it on Saturday. But what it did do is, after that first game, and I'd come away with some learnings, I went, okay, I think I can make this work, and I won my next three games. And that was...
Yeah, if you'd practiced, you could have won all four.
Yeah, probably could have. And I said to my opponent at the end of the day, who I played in round one, I said, I think I'd actually have a crack at it the second time round, knowing what I know now. And he agreed when I explained my thoughts, whether I'd win the game or not, I certainly don't think I would have lost it as bad.
Well, not now, you told him what you're going to do.
But by taking that list, there are a lot of people who went, oh, you're running 30 Striking Scorpions, you're running Rangers, you're running Phoenix Lords and Elite Knight Spear and all these units that in 7th edition tournament play you would never see. They were an unknown quantity to anyone who wanted to end up on the top tables. I finished 7th out of, I think, 30, which is a pretty respectable finish given I lost the first game. And on paper, my army doesn't work. My army is not good. But I figured it out, and I played some games, and I learned, and by the last game, I was feeling quite confident with it.
Which comes down to the fact that you've been playing for multiple decades. So, for new players, are they better off to come in playing one of the stronger armies that while they learn it and while they get their head really into all the rules and also into all of the different... the ins and outs of it, and if once they've got that really solid understanding, then they can start playing some of the lesser known armies, or do you just go in and go, you know what, this model is really cool?
I think part of that is going to be driven by your own ability to accept defeat, and by that I mean...
I guess it depends whether you want to play tournaments.
Yeah, look, I mean, Dark Eldar is a great example, because traditionally they have been an army that has been... You play with them, and you'll lose and 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 lose, and you'll either click with it or you won't. And I've seen plenty of players pick them up, play for a while, go, you know what, I can't make this work, this isn't for me, and sell it on. And I think the players who stick with them are the players who go, you know what, I don't care, I love the aesthetics, I really want to paint them, I'm going to persevere and keep trying. It's very easy to fall back on the idea of, I just want to win games, therefore I'll take the most powerful thing. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I also think that the better players are the ones who take the time to learn.
Yeah, but you've got to get to that, you know, like it must be really disheartening to be playing with...
And lose 20 games in a row.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, like, absolutely. I was saying to, when we were talking about Dark Eldar for 7th edition and prior, I must have played at least 20 games before I actually won one against my local Imperial Guard or Astra Militarum player, Dizzy.
Start with Dark Eldar.
No, and it took me a long time to get the hang of it, but...
But it also took you a long time before you started playing with an army that you lost with.
Yeah.
If you'd have started playing with Dark Eldar and you'd lost your first 20 games, would you have kept playing?
Well, that's... I don't know. I mean, I played Harlequins and Rogue Trader, which were a niche army, and then I've kind of stayed with Eldar and Dark Eldar and you know, deviated a little bit over the years into Grey Knights and Dark Angels and Chaos Space Marines, and I've always had some success with all of them. But there are definitely some armies that if you're really concerned about your win-loss ratio and winning games and obviously competing, at least for up until 7th edition, there were armies that I would have said, if you are that keen on it and you're just starting, I wouldn't have suggested you start with them. Because if winning is important, and it's important about everything else, then, yeah, there would be armies I would say that's a bad decision. If, on the other hand, you don't care necessarily about winning your games while you learn to play, maybe it's not so bad, because you've got more driving you than just winning games.
So, for 7th edition, I obviously talked about hearing a lot about Tau and Eldar being stronger armies. What are the other top-tier armies do you reckon that we have that we see often?
Most of the time they either revolve around what's known as a psychic Death Star, where it's a bunch of characters attached to a super unit, and those psychic characters then buff the unit up to the point where it's either unkillable or unbeatable, or both. Or you get things like the Space Marine Battle Companies, where they field so many models, and a lot of them are free because of the way the formations work, that you essentially overwhelm the opponent with too many things to deal with. Neither of those things are unbeatable. In fact, both of those are things that my Corsairs do really well, because that was something I planned for LBO. But, you know, Space Marines in general are always going to be an army list that does well. They're the flagship product of the company. They're always going to be an army that competes well, and all the sub-branches of those will generally be pretty good. Eldar have always been reasonable. There's a couple of editions where they've sort of sat in the lower ends, but generally speaking, the Eldar armies, once you get them to work and whatnot, can be very, very powerful. Tau, again, have been an army that they languished a little bit early on, but certainly in the current 7th edition rule set up very good. And they've got some choices, sadly, that are so good that you just don't take anything else out of the codex. And that's probably the biggest reason we get these consistent metagames across all the different circuits, is because when you look at a Tau codex, what do you want to take? Well, you want to take Riptides, because Riptides are probably the most under-points-valued, over-efficient unit in the game. And if they're not, then they're certainly right up there.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with those.
Yeah. Absolutely. The Riptide will be one that I suspect will be still very good, but the rebalancing of the rest of the game, it's probably going to see other units get better rather than it get worse. With a Tau army, you take a Riptide. You generally see people take what's known as a Buff Mander with a bunch of upgrades that make another unit better at what it does. Or you take an Ethereal for your HQ to make your infantry better. You'd see a Drone Network to buff all the shooting from those units. You'd probably see Storm Surges, or you'd see two or three of the other formations, and then you'd never see things like Vespin, you'd never see things like, I say never for Piranhas, but I did face Piranhas at LVO, and it was one of the games I lost. I think the trick is that the Tau Codex in particular has a number of things that are just so good at what they do, you just don't take anything else. And the Eldar are much the same for 7th edition, where the Eldar jetbike with scatter lasers are so points efficient for what they do, the same at all.
You'd be stupid not to take
them.
Yeah,
pretty much, sadly. And the same with Warp Spiders and the same with Wraith Knights. The Wraith Knight's probably 100 points undercosted for what it is and what it does in the 7th edition rule set. So people who want to get the most for their points will take those units that the rest of the codex isn't bad, but there's a reason why you don't see too many Guardians or Dire Avengers and no Rangers as your troop choices in Eldar. It's because the jet bikes are so good for the points that you pay, there's really no other choice. If the jet bikes, instead of being 27 points a model, were 37 points a model, I'd say that you would actually start seeing some variety, because there are now better and more efficient ways of getting the firepower from other parts of the codex. And the trick with 8th edition is going to be how well Games Workshop balances all of that, because if they're not careful, they can easily end up in the same scenario where you just make something else the best thing to take. And that's good for their sales figures, because they obviously want to sell models, and they're a model company, and you can't begrudge them that. But at the same time, it's not good for the game when there is clear choices to take out of a codex. If there's no...
You won't have those balanced.
Yeah, if you don't have choice, or, sorry, you will always have choice, but if it's an artificially driven choice because, well, why would I ever take anything else? And if you're in it for competition, you're in it to win, then that's not a healthy place for that book, because it just generates an army that everyone knows about, and then you'll actually struggle to win games with, because other codexes that are more flexible or have more options will beat it, because they will have those options.
I struggle listening to what you're saying, because I'm not an overly competitive person. So if we play board games, I tend to cheat for the other team. I'm not hugely competitive at all. But I'm sitting here thinking, well, why wouldn't you want to win?
Yeah.
Like, it's a game. You obviously want to win the game. That's why you're playing. So as much as I'm hearing you talking, thinking it sounds as though you're really pushy that, you know, people are in this only in the game, and that. Coming across a bit almost like an insult to people that, well, if you're our only to win, then you're going to do this. But it's a game, and the whole point is to try and win it. Like, that's not an insult to say that somebody's choosing an army because it's strong and it's going to win.
No, and I think over the years, the competitive gamers have got a really bad rap for wanting to win a game. And I think it just comes down to what you want to get out of a hobby, because there are plenty of players who want to play it for the stories and the narrative, and they take units that are considered subpar because it's part of their army that they've spent years building, and they've always taken, and their general's always been this model, so they're not going to change it just for the sake of a competition. And that then comes down to their expectations of a competition. I took that army on a couple of weekends ago, knowing that those choices were not the best in the army that I could take, and knowing that I had better options. But I took them because I wanted to take them, not for any other reason than I just wanted to try it out and see what happened.
You still would have liked to win.
Yeah, of course I would. Yeah. And I did my damnedest to try and win.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the way people approach that winning aspect of the game, and the way they comport themselves,
yeah,
in the winning or losing of the games is what gives competitive players a bad name, because...
And you say that, and I've heard so much about tournament players being devils, but I've never seen anyone have a tantrum because they haven't won. I've seen players who want to win, I've seen players who roar and shout and get excited and really get involved in the game, and I've seen people who are disappointed because they haven't won, but I've never seen anyone flip a table or shout at anyone or, you know...
No, it's a very rare thing. I mean, I've been to tournaments all around the world, and I've seen the odd...
All right, it's lovely, right?
Well, you've only been to local ones. You won't come with me internationally. I've seen the odd head-butting scenario where players don't get along, and then someone wins and someone gets upset because that's rubbish, I should have won that.
But I also think that there's a difference between not getting on with the player, so having a personality difference with the person who's across the table from you, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you're having a tantrum just because you don't like them.
Yeah. Well, look, part of it's that whack, win at all costs term that gets bandied around so much. And for me, win at all costs is, by its very definition, winning at all costs. You do whatever it takes to win, regardless of cost. And for me, that by definition, includes and wholeheartedly supports the idea of cheating. Now, I never stooped to that to win a tabletop game. Like, what are you doing? You've got your priorities all screwed up. If the most important thing for you is to try and win a game of Toy Soldiers by any means necessary. Yeah. So people are all too quick to label competitive players as win at all costs because they're trying to get the most out of their army and find the rules that make their army the best they can. That's not win at all costs. That's
being a competitive player.
That is a very competitive player because you are looking for ways that the best way to use your army. I suppose the grey area comes when you find a loophole in the rules that clearly isn't intended for what it achieves, but then gives you a scenario which is advantageous for you, and your opponent looks at you and goes, come on, like, clearly that's not the intent. And then the player...
I struggle with that. I have come across that once. Like, really? Do you really want to be that guy?
Yeah, and I think when you hit that point of your opponent going, come on, like, that's clearly not the intent, because there's a slight ambiguity in the rule set. And every game has those weird little... some are better than others, obviously, but I'm sure that every game system has those little things where you go, that's clearly not what's meant to happen, but that's technically legal within the rules. I think when you start reaching that point of that's what you're looking for, those weird little things, you start bordering on that win at all costs mentality. So I think the trick is to recognise that is, at least in my opinion, that is the boundary. If you are now going out of your way to find these weird little loopholes.
So it's around staying within the intent of the game and within the intent.
And of course, we can't know the intent of the author. We can only assume. And often you use precedents, or you look at...
You look at the rules, and you look at the whole feel of the game.
A great example would be when they released Reboot Gilliman for the tail end of the third Gathering Storm book. He's a Lord of War, and technically you can put him in an Imperial Knight Detachment. The Knight Detachment doesn't require that all the models be knights. Gilliman has a rule that allows him to be in any detachment that's Imperial, and the detachment in question has 5 Lord of War slots, and Gilliman is a Lord of War. So you go, oh my god, I can put him in that detachment.
Yeah.
By rules as written, you absolutely can. As the intent, it's a knight household detachment. You probably would say no, he's probably not intended on going in there. And you can take this a step further because, again, by the reading of one of the special rules for that detachment, he could be made a baron, and then he becomes a super heavy walker, and he gets all these other weird rules which are clearly intended to go on a knight. And it actually breaks the game, and I think that's a very good indicator of that particular, at the very least, he's not meant to be made the baron of that detachment because the rules actually stop working. So could you put him in that detachment? Yes. Is it the intent? Probably not. Could you make him the baron? Absolutely not, because the game actually breaks at that point because you've tried to exploit a loophole. And there's a few of those instances through the rules. There's another one that I was looking at with the Corsairs. When I was reading, I went, well, hang on, how does that work? And the TO part of my brain went, that's clearly not, like, that's not what should happen. But I could see how you could argue it the other way. And then when I was talking about it with another player, and when we started talking about how that might work in the game, we very quickly realised the interactions, like, the game breaks. It's clearly not intended to result in that combination. And all of a sudden it was, well, clearly that's not... We've hit a line here where that's not the intent. So, no, I think win at all costs is a very different thing to being competitive, and being competitive means trying to win the event by following the rules to the best of your abilities.
Yeah, and it comes down to ability.
And that ability starts at list writing and then follows through to deployment and follows through to how you make your decisions on the tabletop and then how you comport yourself through that process. Because if you stood there being a jerk with your hands on your hips, snorting and guffawing and making fun of your opponent, it doesn't matter how good of a general you are, you're still going to be labelled that guy. Because the game, all it's still a game, and by definition, games are
supposed to be fun.
They're competitive, but they're fun. They're meant to be fun. So.
And again, it's not something that I've seen.
No.
And I really appreciate that.
Although, I do see mates every now and again ripping each other apart when they play, but at the same time, they're friends, and that's their relationship. Yeah, that's the way they behave. It's not a negative thing. So,
it is a negative thing, but it's not men,
you know. No.
Men are
weird. But that's kind of my take on the whole whack and competitive play and the meta. So, what is the Perth meta? In 7th edition, it's actually a fairly broad spectrum because a lot of players don't care.
Which is awesome. Well,
those players bring their armies that they've worked on tirelessly over months or years and they're proud of and they want to show off and they want to play games with.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily have a scene which follows the internet. We're isolated like that, so we are in an advantageous position.
Yeah, doing our damnedest to reduce that isolation.
We are, but at the same time, it does mean that the influence that the internet has over us is actually minimised because we are our own little pool. We don't have the ability, like in America on the east coast of Australia, to travel easily to events that could then artificially change the way locals play. So we've only ever had a handful of times where someone's brought something from outside of our environment and everyone's gone, wow, what is that? Or how do we deal with that? Or, wow, you know, it's something that is completely out of the realms of what we would normally see. You know, we had a local, Dan, at one point was bringing 3 Storm Ravens. And that screwed a whole bunch of people up because everyone was going, oh my God, like we'd never see flyers. So people started bringing anti-aircraft weapons and that kind of balance refreshed itself and Dan started bringing 1 or maybe 2. Rather than 3. And we've seen people go, oh, I'm going to bring nothing but Imperial Knights. And then sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, depending on the matchups and depending on who they play. And, we see the game shift itself. Anyway.
So, in a very quick conclusion, don't worry about what the meta is. Play the army that you enjoy playing and play with it, practice with it, learn it inside out. And that's what's going to get you winning the games.
Yeah.
Don't cheat. And if you break the game, you're not playing it right.
It is essentially, yeah. If you find the loophole where the game stops working, you've gone too far down the rabbit hole.
Did I miss anything?
I think that's it.
Very brief wrap-up there. Awesome.
Well, that's the conversation in a nutshell. Hopefully you got some interesting information out of it. It was one that was a very casual conversation, and it was only a little way into it that we kind of really got into our stride. But I suppose it highlights some of the importance about the metagame, as much as it really bothers me that terminology is used and thrown about, because you are essentially gaming the game, which is the whole point of this episode. And I think I'll kind of reiterate what I said earlier in the recording, in that the best players don't live in the metagame. They help drive the metagame. They help develop new ideas and how armies function on the table. They come up with new combinations and tactics and ways to use things that people might otherwise have discarded because they don't fit within the predetermined best unit category. And I think the fact that we're going to have 8th edition 40k fall on us probably in the next couple of weeks, I think the pre-orders are tomorrow, so it's going to be really interesting when that book is made available and all the army books are available and we actually get the opportunity to get some games and see where the where everyone falls in regards to the pecking order of what used to be the meta and what were the best choices and the best armies. If you're on Facebook or on the internet at all, you'll have already likely seen some of the leaked photos of some of the rules. And there's already plenty of feedback and backlash and happiness and rage from players about those rules because it is a completely different game and it's going to really change the way that the competitive community interacts with the game and it'll certainly change the pecking order, not just of armies, but potentially of players. You're going to have really top players who should stay top players, but when you've got a new rule set under your belt, it's that time to actually go out there and have a chance at beating those top players because those top players are in the same boat as everyone else. But the best opportunity you have now with this new game is to play heaps of games, get yourself familiar with the game, and then take what you want to take and make it work. And I can't stress that enough. I'm fortunate to have a very extensive collection for 40K, and that means that when I do decide I want to take a weird army like I took to Kwinana not so long ago, I wanted to take Striking Scorpions. I took 30 of them, and I've got 30 more here that I decided I wanted to paint back then before the announcement for 8th, so I could run a double Aspect Host. Well, the Aspect Host is gone, but I can still run 60 Striking Scorpions in the new format, which is amazing based on what we've seen. So, am I going to do it? Absolutely. Are they going to be the best unit? I don't know yet. They look pretty good. So, I suppose that's a conversation for another episode, though. So, thank you very much to Emma for essentially doing the interview side of that that conversation. And you'll note it here again on future episodes, as you have in the past ones. Look, until next time, though, guys, have some fun, play some games, and we'll see you on the next episode. Cheers.
You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us, obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.